Well, this has been great fun here, and I've been kind of surprised at finding myself doing nothing regarding post-Boomerang and Maxima stuff. But it's been exciting to watch, even without having my own work on that subject to talk about it. I think that it's just great. And even though I'm talking about something else different, and this is not my venture off into planets. Although I sympathize with Douglas's point, but I am talking about something completely different. I'm talking about probing early structure formation with far infrared background fluctuations, so I'll have Doug's attention no matter how hungry he is, I think. And this is work I've done with at Chicago with Asanta Kure, Daniel Eisenstein, and well, no longer at Chicago, Zoltan Hyman. And also, it's been, I owe a debt to Steve Meyer for asking a couple of years ago, you know, what can we learn from looking at the far infrared background? So the first thing that I'll talk about is foreground. So what are the astrophysical confusing sources on the sky that make this difficult? And this is an important thing to address. First, because there's at low frequencies, there's this annoying microwave background, which can cause problems. And then at higher frequencies, of course, at all frequencies, the galactic dust is potentially a problem for looking at this, because we're looking at dust from just the high redshift galaxies. So I'm going to just start off talking about that. But I can make the point that we're talking about foregrounds, that actually the spectrum of the Firm anisotropy, I think, can actually be measured well in spite of these foreground problems. And that measuring it probes this combination. If we take from CMB data and other probes of large-scale structure, that we're going to soon have small uncertainties, certainly depending on your choice of priors. But for reasonable choices of priors, small uncertainties in what the matter power spectrum is doing over a large range of redshifts. And so what we'll be measuring here is some combination of an average emissivity per unit volume times some bias, which potentially actually depends on K, nu, and Z in its most general form. So I'm going to take a model of this and forecast errors on these parameters of this model. So first of all, just foregrounds. I'm one of those people who sent email to Doug Finkbeiner. Right. And he was sent very helpful replies. I recommend emailing him to all of you. Uh-oh, I'm going to get no more help from Doug. What I did was I took a... first of all, actually, Jean-Louis Puget told me a couple months ago that you know, there's really great variation in the amount of dust contamination in the sky. Now, this is something I know a lot of people know, but I hadn't realized the magnitude of the variation that and mostly these, you know, like the Tegmark et al. Compendium on foreground contamination, these are, I think people mostly think about satellite missions for these. And so you really, these estimates of the power spectrum from different foregrounds are done for the, you know, the cleanest half of the sky. There are regions that are much, much better than what you get, you know, fluctuation power from averaging over the cleanest half of the sky. And if you're satisfied with 1% of the sky, there are 20 degree by 20 degree patches, which are a lot cleaner. So I just took a 80 degree by 80 degree patch around the South Galactic Pole. So this is all, you know, greater than 30 degrees away from the plane. So it's all high latitude stuff. And it's all pretty decent already. And then I just broke it up into 256 5 degree by 5 degree patches and 16 20 degree by 20 degree patches, used this stuff here to extrapolate to 300 gigahertz for the dust, and calculated the variance in each of the patches. And so you see, this is the log base 10 of the variance divided by the mean variance. And here's the mean, and you can do a lot better than the mean. There's a number of these 5 degree by 5 degree patches that are a lot better. This is the histogram for the 20 degree by 20 degree patches, and so you can do a lot better than the mean in patches that size as well. And this is not true. This case isn't quite the same for synchrotron. I think that there's the scale height for the synchrotron is larger in the galaxy, and so we don't quite have these same holes through the contaminants as we do with the galactic dust. Yeah, well, this is a log plot. Right. All the dust patches are above average, or fortunately, all of them are below average. I don't think it's a result of the resolution, because these are all, at least I looked at the power spectrum for the dust, they all look like L to the minus 3. You're dominated by your largest scales. I'm using the Haslam map as cleaned up, done by Doug. And if you just look at it, though, I mean, you see there just isn't as much variation in that, even on larger scales.
There are indications there's smaller scales. Uh-huh.
Okay. Before I realized while preparing for this talk that I have to say something about this experiment called FERBAT, which the help here is, because this is an awful name. It stands for Far Infrared Background Anisotropy Telescope. It went into a proposal as a placeholder, never got fixed. I came up with a good substitute for it, only to find out there was another called HEAT, High Z Emission Anisotropy Telescope, only to find out that down the hall at Chicago there was another balloon-borne experiment with that acronym. And so if anybody has a better name, please let me know. Firm ball. It may be better, but significantly better, please. Right. So this is an experiment with a 1 meter primary, an array of frequency selective bolometers. These are bolometers stacked so that actually the filter system is really joined with the bolometer, so that you have photon coming in here and the high frequency band is picked up here. Everything else is passed on. This picks up the next lowest frequencies, and so you can really pack a lot of oomph into a focal plane. So the plan is for 7 pixels times these 8 detectors with 6 arc minute resolution, and then one that's just 1 pixel times 5 detectors at 14 arc minutes. And this is we wanted to get this thing. This is our CMB monitor channel. So get rid of that annoying CMB stuff. So here is some plots of what the sky might look like in these frequencies. This is dust is averaged over 50% of the sky. This is dust. A third of the 20 degree by 20 degree patches have this level of dust fluctuation or less in that, which I was just showing you. So you really get a big gain. These are predictions for far infrared background fluctuations. This is a correlated part and the shot noise from the discrete nature of the sources. So you see over a wide range of frequencies, this far infrared background is possibly the dominant source of fluctuation power on some well-chosen regions of the sky. The dotted points here are actually then how well you can measure it, taking the given channel plus the CMB monitor channel to clean out the CMB. And so these are, so you can actually measure it quite well with this. So, okay, well, what do we know already about the sky in these regions? Well, we know something about the sources that are contributing to this from observations with SCUBA. Here's a compilation from Barger et al. And so the point source is known from 2 to 10 millijanskis. Here's a model for this source count distribution. If you look at this as instead, I don't have the data plotted on here, but I have that model that was, which was kind of going through the data. This is S squared dNdS, and I plot that because that's the contribution to just the mean background in every logarithmic interval in S. And so this SCUBA is probing this range, which is near the peak of this distribution. So it's probing the stuff that really is contributing to the mean of the far infrared background. And this is a fit that Scott and White did to early SCUBA data. And so this is the range of brightnesses. So if we're looking at the background, looking at the fluctuations of the background, we're actually be probing, you know, that this is actually due to sources that we're seeing with SCUBA. There's also people here could tell us more about a balloon-borne experiment called BLAST, which is going to be able to pick out stuff brightward of there in this distribution and be able to do some color redshifts and identify where some of these sources are in redshift. If we take, so we can look at what we know about the FIRB monopole from that stuff. But here's this model E. Here is a very crude model for the mean emissivity, its prediction for the temperature. This is actually though constrained by the PhiRS measurement. This is the Fixon et al. They took a gray body form to fit to the slope of the far infrared, the spectrum of the far infrared background. And you'll notice that this doesn't look like gray bodies you're used to. This is very shallow here. And that's because what's happening is you're adding in no one on that side of the room can see this, but if you take some gray body spectrum that looks like this, and then you add in a colder component, and you add in another colder component, then you really flatten out the spectrum like this until you get to a coldest component, and then there's a break in the spectrum. You no longer have that flattening. And the PhiRS data is really crapping out around here. These models predict that there should be some turnover in this region, and which is a signature of where how high a Z are you getting contributions to from the far infrared background. And unfortunately, you know, PhiRS just doesn't constrain things well here. And it's going to be really difficult to improve upon that because the CMB really is a whopping signal here. And fortunately, though, the CMB has very tiny anisotropies. And so we can actually hope to measure the spectrum of the far infrared background anisotropy better than the spectrum of the mean at those lower frequencies. In order to kind of pursue the structure of what we could learn from studying these far infrared background fluctuations, we needed a model for the fluctuations. And there's certainly room for development here in this modeling, but this is done to have an understanding of what kind of level of anisotropy to expect and what the structure of the observables are and what we can hope to learn. And so this model, which we wrote about came out this year, is just a model for the emissivity per Kolmogorov unit volume. So the idea is that you have dust in these galaxies heated up by starlight. And so the what we do is just assume that the UV light is proportional to some star formation rate, and our baseline model is some Madow fitting formula for the star formation rate as a function of redshift, global star formation rate. We assume that dust production is proportional to the star formation rate. And then if we assume optical properties for the dust, then we can get a mean temperature. These proportionality constants we choose so that we can roughly agree with FIRAS. Then all we do to get the fluctuations is assume that this far infrared light is a biased tracer of the mass, and do this integral, and we get something that actually looks quite similar to a guess by Scott and White. I don't know, can I call it a guess? Based on an estimate of what this should be, based on clustering of Lyman-Break galaxies and assuming these cluster like Lyman-Break galaxies. They were quite pleased to see how well our thing agreed with theirs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, that depends on the bias. The amplitude is you know, so thinking of the bias of 3, then we get an amplitude like theirs. If the bias is less than that, then it'll scale down. Okay, great. So the why do we want to actually extend this to lower frequencies, down to, like, why do we want to extend the far infrared background at 210 gigahertz? Well, it is the lower, as you go into lower frequencies, you're actually seeing out the higher redshifts, because it's taking longer to get to the peak of the gray body spectrum of these galaxies. If you're an astronomer, there's the negative K correction that lasts for even longer from lower frequencies. doesn't matter who you are. If you're an astronomer, you might understand that. And so you see here this contribution of the power spectrum from different redshift intervals. So here the redshift intervals are labeled down here. I just highlighted in blue from lowest redshift 0 to 0.5. You're getting this contribution at 850 gigahertz. There's a big drop to the 2 to 4 contribution at 850 gigahertz. At 210 gigahertz, however, that low redshift contribution is subdominant compared to the 2 to 4, the redshift 2 to 4 contribution. then there's also the fact that the shape of the power spectrum contribution from these different intervals is different. That the nearby stuff, you're getting a much flatter spectrum just because you're actually more into the scale invariant part of the matter power spectrum is what you're probing. I don't think so. I mean, it depends on the model. I think I'm not, you know, so I should have, you know, 320 here and see it. It may look quite similar to the 210. It depends on the model and how much fluctuation power you have going on at high redshift. If you have a lot of fluctuation power going on at high redshift, then you want to keep going to lower frequency. Another way of looking at this is if instead of some lambda CDM cosmology, which the previous thing assumed, if you have some power law cosmology, then actually each L probes redshift in the same way. But however, there's certainly this change in frequencies of how you're probing redshift. And you're going out to much higher redshift with 210 than certainly with 1,090. If you have a lambda CDM cosmology, then even at fixed frequency, you're probing different redshifts with different L's. Yes. Right. We're averaging over lots of them. Yeah, you're gonna look. This is what we have the technology to measure. there is a 1 meter dish already. I think everybody. Well, this is an important issue, so I will stop with it. I mean, joking aside, this. No, 20 degree by 20 degree stuff. No, you can do this 20 degree by 20 degree. This is what this is based on. We want them both.
What you want to do is extract money.
Look, we're talking about something that is in parts of the sky the dominant source of fluctuation power. It has to do with, you know, it's going to constrain models of galaxy formation at high redshift. These things are not that it's not that easy to go after the same thing going after the sources. It's very difficult. So if we could get all the sources and see individual sources at each redshift, you know, then great. Then there's no need for this, because then you just add that up and you get the diffuse flux. But I think that's... What? Well, that's what I'm saying, is that there's no extra information in that. But you need a lot of those. You need a lot of those to actually be able to measure the biases at the different redshifts. And... Well, it's hard to do. Jason? Go ahead. Well, it depends on what L you're talking about. So at L greater than 1,000, then the shot noise is dominant.
Okay.
Right. So I think we're probing stuff that is in this range. That's really what's contributing to the background. Now, there may be, you know, we may be preferentially shifting one way we're looking at the fluctuations, because possibly the brighter ones are more strongly biased than the less bright ones. But it's not going off, you know, that's not going to be pushing you out into this tail. Actually, the shot noise is much more low, is more out here. Well, that's, if I'm making a different point, then I would show that plot. I mean, this is not, the fluctuations I'm talking about that I'm interested in are not the shot noise. If I were interested in the shot noise, then you're right, I should be showing that plot, which actually starts to diverge right here, and you have to cut off at one source per, 4 pi to actually have it converge. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that what's given rise to the electrical correlation is going to be dominated by ordinary things?
No. Ordinary. Yeah. Yeah, I think this is more, galaxy formation.
the only way you can deal with it, I think it's very interesting itself. It's
good stuff, but there are a lot of parameters
inside.
Well, if they're tracing out, you know, if they're telling us something about merger rates, then I think they do. Yeah. Well, you know, there's not even an experiment built yet. How could it be clear that it's high quality information? Right. No, I think this is interesting stuff. I mean, I think that there's interesting theoretical challenges to this. I think it's a clear thing to do with the technology at Fable. I think there's interesting science to come out of it. You know, I hope some other people. Very different fashion, right? No, and there's certainly stuff to, you know, to build off of as far as, you know, the semi-analytic modeling that's been done and will be extended.
Isn't there a community out there that thinks the way to get at this is to build a 10-meter class thing put centimeters, kilometers on it, and then look at these things directly and add them up to get the power set?
I think that's great. You know, I mean.
So the question is, can this happen sooner or?
Yes. Yeah. Sooner, cheaper. Yeah. I'm not an experimentalist, you know, but I feel qualified to say that this could be done cheaper. What was the question? Right. No, it's not root n. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's you know, so there's structure in this, right? This. Exactly, because you're probing different redshifts with different frequency ranges, you don't have perfect coherence. And so I plotted nu prime versus just this correlation coefficient. And, you know, this certainly depends on the model, since it's, anyway, it's another structure in the observable here. Well, as long as I might as well say something about it. So this is nu prime at 390 gigahertz, so it's perfectly correlated with itself. As you're going to higher frequencies, you're not getting contributions from the as high a redshift as 393 is, and so you're not totally correlated with it. And that's since the higher L's are preferentially probing the higher redshift, it's more of an effect for the higher L's than the lower L's. This would be a stronger effect in a model that actually had more fluctuation power at high Z than this baseline model. Yeah. I mean, That's right, to use these different frequencies to actually get some handle on where things are happening in redshift. Okay, now no one's going to look at this given that it's 12:30 and it's pretty full. There's this, so what I've defined this this quantity named after some frequent collaborators of mine. I thought about calling it B sub J just to really confuse optical observers, but which is just this product which enters in, which is there's just no way of separating these things that in they all always enter into the CL nu nu prime with this with it, as this product. Anyway, I've parameterized it here with an amplitude, one for each of four redshift bins, and then a spatial dependence. So think of this as a spatial dependence of the bias, with one index for each of four redshift bins, and then actually just one spectral parameter. Now that you know things are going to be more complicated than this for sure. This is just intended to give some indication of the richness of what you can do with this. And I've lost my punchline plot. I found it. So the squares are the amplitude, the error in the amplitude. Triangles are errors in that index. Dotted line is no marginalizing over other parameters. The solid line is marginalizing over everything, including that spectral dependence parameter. And then the intermediate stuff is marginalizing over intermediate thing, intermediate subsets of things. Anyway, so in this parameterization, there are some things you can measure really well, marginalizing over the other things that are confused with these. Still, you have this biased version of the emissivity of the function of redshift actually measured to 10%. And I'll just move on to my conclusions. So there are sizable regions of the sky where the dust emission is very quiet. By the way, of course, this has applications to other things besides this. If you want to measure polarization, most polarization experiments, you want to measure... you're probably going to be going after much smaller patches of sky than half of the sky, and it's great advantage to pick the really clean regions. And this actually kind of strengthens the case for 100 gigahertz or 200 gigahertz to measure polarization over lower frequencies, because it's harder to find these really clean regions in at 30 gigahertz than at 200, since the synchrotron doesn't show as much variation. This point, the far from background from 400 to 1,000 gigahertz, may be the dominant source of fluctuation power in these clean regions. Measurements of this thing will provide a rich set of constraints on models of early galaxy formation. And Furbat is an awful name. Please help. Thanks. Dick. I didn't in the parameter space. I did for the for the CLs and like in that four panel plot I showed, and it does brilliantly. The sensitivity is higher even on the part of the sky. Planck actually has Planck's interesting. Actually, there are some correlations that there's actually a significant correlation with the lensing of the CMB. That when you have the sensitivity of Planck, you can actually go after, which has some information about you, that has a change with frequency because of these. The correlation with lensing is strong is because these windows in redshift look a lot like a lensing window, so there's a lot of correlation, and the degree of correlation will change with frequency because your window in redshift space is changing with frequency. So there's interesting stuff to do regarding this with Planck as well. It goes beyond what we can do with Furbat. Ned?
Well, you talked about the proposal. What kind of proposal was this, or is this?
It's an excellent proposal.
That's where we're going to carry you about the atmosphere.
Oh, it's a balloon-borne mission.
Okay, so
yeah.
What length of time?
This is, sorry, yeah, this is 10 days. 10 days, the predictions were 10 days, using half of our detectors, because everybody knows that's what you do. Right, well, we were it's a proposal. Yeah, Doug. They meant new squared. Yeah. Look, not for the galactic dust, right?
All the galaxies look like our galaxy.
Yeah.
So I'm not just asking this to be a nuisance.
Drainily got unlucky. They live in the one galaxy that's... Oh, no.
No, if this break is there, then that would actually maybe be measurable this way, because you might see the break.
You want us to use this to further destroy new squared dust. Okay. No. That's a really good question. My collaborators aren't here, so they can't contradict me on this statement about design. But they may be listening on the internet. this is actually the number of channels was actually originally driven by the desire to be able to separate out galactic dust and not knowing how horrible that would be, and just thinking we want as many controls as we can on fitting out parameters of dust in our own galaxy. That's what drove that. With these, so I don't know. Now we should go back and rethink this.
So of course, adding frequency channels is going to decrease sensitivity elsewhere.
Why? With these FSBs, it's not. Headaches. You mean an RN to complement that, or you mean are those missions?
Surveys are being
designed. Right.
Without much of this kind of thinking being factored in.
Right. No, I know. I haven't. The thing is that what's discouraging about that, I think that will be really interesting. What's discouraging about it is really, what 160 microns is there, and so you really nice to be down near 850 microns. We are totally confused.
So my question is, do you think you can get down that heat over 10 square degrees, or however many square degrees, 400 in a flight?
Yeah.
Basically, you're doing a PFD analysis with looking for L.
Yeah. Mark. No, but I'm sure some future unwitting enrollee at Davis will. So is Boomerang. Is it a nightmare, Max, or is it just, you know, just look like a great playground? And we will, when we reduce our data, we'll hand out the maps with covariance matrices. We'll give the Fisher matrix for our power spectrum estimations and the offset log normal things. And as we submit the first paper. I'm talking about a, you know, 20 degree by 20 degree thing at higher resolution than Boomerang. Yeah. It's a lot of work. We probably have to punish a few graduate students.
But why aren't people incorporating in every new design these stackalometers? It seems to me to be a pretty good idea.
New designs.
Well, no, but I mean, you know, what you find boring, the primary anecdotes,
is it the main thing? No, yeah, when they exist, all the great technologies are going to be
capture all photons all the time.